Stephen Yarwood became the youngest Lord Mayor in the history of Adelaide when he was elected in 2010. He first joined the Adelaide City Council in 2007 after nearly 20 years working as a town planner, and he's in the process of being potentially re-elected for his second term with elections coming up later this year. Stephen has an MBA as well as postgraduate qualifications in regional and urban planning and environmental studies. He's lectured in planning and management in several countries, as well as studying future cities in Tsutsuba, Japan's technology city. He's articulated a vision for Adelaide as a modern, vibrant and sustainable place to do business, to live and enjoy life, and he's committed to working hard to ensure federal, state and local government work in partnership with businesses and the community to see that Adelaide releases its full potential. So, Stephen, what do you see as the role of local government in Australia's future?
Well, thank you for that, Charles. And firstly, I want to thank you for inviting me here tonight. And it's a great pleasure to be here. I always enjoy coming to Melbourne. It's a pity it's for such a short time this time, but I'm sure there'll be plenty more opportunities. And I'm going to touch on local government, but also talk more generally about cities, because I think local government is about cities and cities are about local government. So I guess to a certain extent, want to introduce myself, and I guess you have, in that I started my urban planning degree, the journey of studying cities, at exactly the same time that the South Australian government was successful in getting a project called the Multifunction Polis, the MFP. And I remember John Bannon announcing it and deciding that we were going to build a city of the future with the Japanese government. And I remember deciding at the time that that's what I was going to study. I was going to study the future of cities. So I've gone about that through working in state government and being a researcher in Parliament. And then I was a principal town planner at the city of Playford, which is a big local government in South Australia. But ultimately, I got a little bit restless being told what to do if I didn't necessarily agree with it, and decided to just go out and knock on a few doors in my community. I made a New Year's resolution to speak to strangers. And I've been probably overcooked it a little bit, and I've been speaking to strangers ever since, and still can't believe I'm the Lord Mayor of what is one of the most beautiful and wonderful cities in the world. But ultimately, I ran for Lord Mayor because I believe in the transformation of cities. If I could cite Melbourne as a great example, this was a downtown district that 20 years ago that was, and I won't swear, but it was not particularly nice, and it has transformed into arguably, or maybe even definitively, one of the most beautiful downtown districts of any city in the entire world. Just recently, Robert Doyle was proudly out there, a friend of mine, a mentor, a supporter of mine, boasting about the fact that Melbourne had just become the world's most livable city yet again. He did mention, though, that Adelaide was nipping at its heels as the fifth most livable city and number two in Australia, which is good, and I appreciate the fact that the Lord Mayor of Melbourne even utters the words Adelaide. That's a good start. But certainly, my business is cities, and in terms of the future, cities, this is going to be the century of cities. Right now there's about 400 cities in the world, over a million people, and by 2025 there will be over 500 cities in the world, over a million people. In fact, we tipped over to 50% of the world's population living in urban environments just 2 years ago, and once again by about 2025 or 2030, they estimate that 70% of the world's population will live in urban environments. That's 7 billion people. In fact, it's the number of people that live on the planet today be living in urban environments within the next 15 to 20 years. And so we are really, in local government and the governance of cities, the custodians of change. It's ultimately about the fact that this is where the energy is consumed, it's where the resources go, it's where the waste comes out of, it's where the carbon emissions are. It's quite literally, from my perspective, the front line of the future. And ultimately, local government is a really exciting level of government, because it's very much about getting things done on time, on budget. It is totally accountable. I live my entire life in a transparent glass box, and we often regularly deliver on time and on budget. And it's about being responsive, it's about being connected, it's about actually delivering outcomes in real time in a way that the federal government could never achieve, the state governments are increasingly less able to do because of their scale. And so there is a whole conversation around if mayors rule the world. And in a century where cities are the brands rather than the regions or even the countries, we don't talk about coming from Victoria, we talk about coming from Melbourne. If we live in the United States, we're either from New York or San Francisco. We're not from California. And this whole notion that cities are actually the pointy end, that's where the people live, and that's where the business is done, that's where the experiences are had. And of course, when we fly to different regions, we land in the middle of the cities, and they are always our starting point for our experience of that region. So modern regions will define their success, their aspirations for the future, based on their central business district and the face that they put forward to the world. I describe local government as the business of life. If we don't do it, we're meant to know who does. And we're meant to be able to connect those dots and help make it happen. So it's about cities need to be resilient in terms of change, adaption, leading, providing not only the outcomes but influencing. As a mayor of a city, I don't actually have power. In fact, no Lord Mayor of Australia has power. What they do have is influence. And it's ultimately about how a mayor can get a community to share a vision and actually understand that vision and get everyone to move in that direction. My ambition for the future of Adelaide is I want to walk around the city of Adelaide in 20 years' time and still see things unfold that I would have liked to have seen unfold, and that you can actually infuse change into communities and actually see them go off in a different direction. It's also about this sense of co-creation and curation. Just as an art gallery owner doesn't paint the paintings, the mayor doesn't actually build everything and do everything. It is about curating the city, creating outcomes. I like to say that people achieve great things when motivated, and I think the role of a mayor, the role of local government, is to inspire people. It's to make them believe in their city and get outcomes. And that sense of co-creation, which I'll talk about it in a little moment. I just wanted to touch on three examples of where local government is influencing and can influence into the future how the world actually will operate, and in terms of how humans interact with the planet and the destiny of civilization, if I can, you know, be a futurist for a moment. Firstly, one is digital cities. That's something that I'm particularly keen on because I'm very keen on social media. Robert and I have a bit of fun in this space. Robert's got a lot more followers on Twitter than I do, for example. He's got about 40 or 50,000 followers, and I'm just about to get to 10,000. But I also use Facebook, I use LinkedIn, I use Instagram. And it's actually not about how many followers you've got, it's actually how you use it and how you engage with people and how you generate a conversation. And so this idea of actually understanding that the digital side of things is really going to change cities in a really profound way. I actually call it the common language of binary digits talking to each other through embedded devices throughout our public and private realm that will actually change how cities live, breathe and tick. Information ecology, the ability for humans to move through a city and interact with the curvature of the earth in a completely different way based on information actually providing the ability for humans to change and change their operating system. So this is actually a whole new operating system for cities. Right now, we are really quite literally just dumb cities. Even this room, you know, I mean no disrespect to our hosts. I see fancy fires burning in the ceiling, just as we had fires in the corner of a cave. But other than that, realistically, we really haven't got to the point where we are interacting with the room in a different way based on technology. Now, does this room have a Wi-Fi network? What are the smart sensors and the ability to sense walking in and out of a room and change the lights and actually understand when the water needs to be refilled, or that plant over in the corner might actually be dry? Technically speaking, the lovely young lady at the front desk might actually be able to see that on her computer and know when that plant needs to be watered, for example. So we're really going to start to see a whole different operating system, not only of a room and a house and a building, but also a neighbourhood and a region and an entire city. And I've got some wonderful examples that I guess I want to share to really sort of help you understand where this is all going to go. And we all sit around at barbecues talking about how amazing our smartphones are and how, you know, it's just like Captain Kirk. But the truth is that this is just the tip of an iceberg of what is going to be a paradigm shift and an entire new operating system for cities that we can't even really see coming yet, but is going to happen and transform before our very eyes. And I stress there are going to be winners and losers. And my goal in terms of Adelaide, but indeed Australian cities, is I'd really hope that we could be the winners in a global race in the business of cities, where we're the smart cities and we're ahead of the curve, because that curve will always be there. And depending on where we are on that journey, we'll always be ahead or behind. So I've just come back from the World City Summit in Singapore and seen some wonderful examples. Real-time, three-dimensional digital maps of a city that actually show the traffic jams, that show the density of pedestrian movement, that show which bins are full and which bins are empty, and start to actually map that in real time so you can start to see the behaviour patterns and understand where the bins need to go and also how often they need to be emptied. There are sensors in bins in Singapore now that say when they're full, and they provide that service so that you can actually be much more reliable in terms of using staff resources to empty those bins or put more bins in, or actually say that bin doesn't need to be there, it could be moved 10 metres that way because that's where the density of population is. And I saw face recognition for cameras around our cities that really are starting to change how cities are being managed. Just 10 years ago we were talking about privacy. I can tell you now that the community is screaming for more CCTV. And the truth is CCTV is not just now a policeman sitting behind a camera watching. It is actually picking up the face of people, and you can track a person through an entire public realm. In the city of New York alone, if I wanted to find a woman wearing a red jumper in all of Manhattan, it could happen in about 30 seconds. Downtown New York can now sense when a vehicle drives past the City Hall three times within half a day, going on average slower than the normal car, to pick up potential terrorist attacks. They run algorithms that can see these patterns. They can identify a bag that has been left for more than 30 seconds throughout the entire city of New York within seconds, and actually start to track that sort of behaviour and those sorts of have that sort of monitoring. So we are able to use those cameras in a whole pile of different ways, and it's all about affecting this whole new economy. But it's not just the economy, it's not just the ability for businesses to make money, it is quite literally the productivity of a city, the livability of a city, and the sustainability of a city in a way that's never happened before. I'll give you some examples. So demand pricing is going to be a really big part of this. So you think about the pizza shop, the modern pizza shop. You go into that shop, there's no prices of any of the pizzas on the walls anymore, because the price is different on a Tuesday night to it is on a Saturday night. And this whole sense of when there is no demand, you lower the price, and when there's a higher demand, you raise the price. I remember going to an internet cafe in downtown London, and in the middle of the day, there was only one or two machines empty, and it was about £5 for 15 minutes. I did go out and have a good time, and I walked past that internet cafe at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was only three people using any of the machines, and there was 150 machines, and I could get 5 minutes for 5p. And so the ability to start to control. Now, if you apply that to car parking, to roads, to actually starting to use all of the infrastructure in a city, the price of a car park can drop when it goes beyond a certain point to encourage people to come into that space. But when that car park is full, the price can go up. You can even actually demand price public transport and car parking to actually provide a mathematical variability. You know, it's that sense of, and I'll get to that in a minute, how do you get a million people in and out of a city every day? If you do it by cars alone, we're all in big trouble. But if you actually do the demand pricing, you can really start to change behavioural patterns. And using this sort of technology, you can actually wake up in the morning and say, what's the easiest way to get into the city today? What's the cheapest way? What's the quickest way? If you're prepared to pay for it, those sorts of things. And you start to see patterns of human behaviour changing in real time. Another one that's very exciting is augmented reality. So augmented reality is the ability to use an app on your phone, ultimately holding up your phone and using the camera to see the city around you, but you can actually overlay additional information. In Seattle, you can hold your phone up in the markets and see all the old heritage buildings that used to be there through your phone. You can, at WOMAD, the music festival in Adelaide, you can hold it up to see where the public toilets are and where the stages are. We've done a project in Adelaide where you can see dinosaurs walking through the street. And it's confidential, but we are exploring Christmas in the city. Wouldn't it be nice to see Santa and his elves in Rundle Mall using a phone to actually experience the city? Or signage, interpretation, the options are almost endless. Ability to use our phones in different ways. So I always say, hands up who's got a smartphone. Nearly all's got smartphones. You are all geospatial. You are now connected to your cities. And not only do you know where you are, but your phone knows where you are. And if you choose to, other people know where you are. Your apps know where you are. And the ability to move through a city using this as a guidance mechanism actually changes which street you go on, where you choose to go. I may need to use public transport and the bus is going to be, I can see the dot moving on the map. I've got to go in 30 seconds time because the bus is about to come. And interestingly enough, teenagers were interviewed in Europe about whether they would have a car or a smartphone. And pretty much 9 times out of 10, they chose a smartphone because they can actually connect in a much more efficient way with this than they can a big machine with box with four wheels that they've got to fill up with petrol and pay for car parking. And so it's not just Foursquare, it's not just Facebook, it's virtually every single app you have knows where you are and how close you are to things. And now that gives us the ability to move through our city and our city to sense where we are and give us the information that we need to actually have a better quality experience and move through a city in a much more efficient way. And so also it is about connectivity and engagement. A local government might want to ask about a development application. Well, when you walk past that building, your phone might say, what do you think of this design? You could use augmented reality to see what the building would look like, see the shadow that's cast by the building, and start to understand and engage in a much more efficient and effective way. Another example that directly connects to that is a new age of influence through social media. So some of these rather annoying DJs and talkback radio hosts that have a trust rating of 15%, according to latest research, have, in Adelaide at least, about 30,000 listeners. I've got 10,000 followers on Twitter and at the moment only 5,000 followers on Facebook, but I continue to grow that and I'm determined to. And just out of interest, who here has heard of clout? Got one person. Yeah. HR, and that's not surprising. So clout is a software it's a company that measures your influence in social media. So automatically, if you have a Twitter account, it will give you a clout score, and that's a mark out of 100 as to not only how many followers you've got, and it goes back to that conversation I had about Robert Doyle, but how many people retweet your stuff, how many people mention you on social media, how many people like a photograph of yours on Facebook, how many people reshare your stuff on Facebook. It even looks at your LinkedIn account and how many followers you've got on LinkedIn, and looks at your Wikipedia page. My daughter tells me she belongs to a very elite club called Dads with Wiki Pages. So I've got a Wikipedia page. And so it starts to measure that. So Obama has a score of 99. And Justin Bieber has a score of 100. Yeah. If you have a score over 75, you are a celebrity. your tweets last in social media land for about 5 to 7 minutes because they echo. If you have a score over 80, your tweets last 25 minutes and because they continue to echo.
So what score does the Lord Mayor of Adelaide
have? The Lord Mayor of Adelaide has the highest clout score of any Lord Mayor in the country, even though he's the fifth biggest city. So Robert Doyle's got 4 times more followers on Twitter, but I've got a bigger clout score than him. Mm. And that's what bothers him, which I quite enjoy reminding him. And so it's that sense of it's not what you've got, it's how you use it and how you engage and the sorts of content you put up and the accessibility you have for people to debate at a barbecue whether you know it's A or B and then be able to ask the Lord Mayor and have him respond in real time, which makes a huge difference in terms of not only your influence but the faith people have in you and their ability to engage with you and believe you and connect with you and actually be a part of a community. And so in terms of HR, HR companies may well require a certain clout score for certain jobs now. If you want a job in media or you want a job in comms, you might require a score of 50 plus. Hotels are now Googling people to see what their clout score is and providing service/upgrades commensurate to their clout score. Cathay Pacific will provide access to the business lounge in the San Francisco airport if you have a clout score over 60. And so it's not about whether you're on radio or on TV. It is a mathematical score calculated every day that goes up or down, that commensurate to your ability to influence a community. Now, if you're walking, if you're geo-connected and your clout score is public information and you walk through a shopping centre, you're going to be offered 50% here, 30% there. Come in and get a freebie there. Audi is giving people with clout scores of a certain score in the US a car for the weekend because they're going to write about their experience. And so this whole sense of a new age of influence where it's not actually about whether you're on TV, it's actually about how much influence you actually have. And corporates are now working very hard, Mike, to actually increase their clout score. So I'd really encourage you to get tweeting because it's really going to make a difference in the short to medium term in terms of how you are provided service and whether you're a part of the in crowd or not to a certain extent. And near field beacons in retail environments will be able to pick that up and provide push notifications for you, and also they'll understand what your hobbies and interests are and be able to directly relate to you. So all of a sudden, you're connected to every single physical space around you with people pushing you or pulling you all sorts of directions. So that's another example. Another one I've mentioned is the transport patterns. So I've touched on it a couple of times, and I will talk about transport in a minute. But also productivity, and I'll give you a great example of productivity just in terms of physical health. QBE Insurance handed out Fitbits, the wristbands, to all their staff, and now they can measure how many calories they burn every day, how many steps they take, and they have seen an active increase in the productivity of their employees. It's that old MBA statement, if it's not measurable, it's not manageable. And the next era of Apple, and Samsung's already done it, so I won't promote one company, is smartwatches that measures your heartbeat, can actually measure your temperature, can measure how much you work, how many calories you do every day, but will actually measure and monitor your health and how many calories you can burn in a day. And if they can do that, you can start to increase the productivity of your business. So, great example right now, obesity is the single biggest killer of Australians. It's now overtaken smoking. 50% of Australians are overweight, and in fact, 1 in 4 Australians are now obese. And this is actually lowering the productivity of our country. In South Australia alone, small businesses lose $300 million of lost economic productivity due to obesity-related illnesses. It costs the federal government $60 billion in our health budget to deal with obesity. This is going to be a major crisis. It is a crisis. We have an obesity epidemic. And the ability to actually start to think about how technology can actually change those behavioural patterns And if it's, you know, I don't wear a watch, I will get a smart watch, because I want to be able to measure my heart rate, the number of calories I burn, and actually start to measure it every single day. I'm a keen cyclist, and so the opportunity to actually monitor all of that as well is a lot of fun. And it increases the productivity of your workers, and it increases the productivity of your city. Another example in terms of health, in Singapore, there was a device that was about the third the size of a telephone box that you stood on, and you held two handles, and it weighed you. Oh, you entered your age, your gender, your height, and it weighed you. It also measured your fat levels by holding the things. It measured your heartbeat and gave you, there was a device, a circular device, you put your arm through it, and it also measured your blood pressure. Take it out, press a button, and it gave you a printout, and it directly connects to your app on the phone, and it gives you your complete health details. Now, this is a device that you can roll outside of a high-rise building, an apartment block, a building, an office building, etc. It takes 30 seconds for you to do it, and everyone in that building can do it once a week. And in fact, they can go back the next week and do it again. And if they've seen an improvement, they get a reward. It's a gaming system. And all of a sudden, you don't have to go to the doctor. You just literally have 30 seconds where you go up, you get your critical analytics, you keep on with your day, and it monitors in your phone and gives you a graph, a weekly, monthly, yearly graph of where you're going. If it's not measurable, it's not manageable. And when was the last time you jumped on the scales? And so there's an opportunity to interact in a way that is actually directly about providing this infrastructure in our cities to connect people. Just as the best art galleries in the world are cities, street art, museums, buildings, our cities now can provide those services in physical spaces in a way that they never have before, and then connect to technology. Another one too I'll give you a tip on, I actually predict the end of car parking fines, which is really, really exciting, because we are now seeing smart sensors under every single parking space. And there's two options. One is that the longer you stay right outside the bank where you wanted to park, because you expect to be able to drive into a city of 5 million people and park right outside the front of where you want to go, the first 15 minutes might be $1, second 15 minutes might be $10, the third 15 minutes might be $50. And if you're prepared to pay for that, you're prepared to park out the front, you can pay that price. Alternatively, it might be that you can only stay 15 minutes. And the reason we do that is because those businesses survive on turnover and accessibility. The only reason there's parking fines is because you don't circulate the cars, no one else comes. If in the city of Adelaide, there's 11,000 on-street car parks, there's 250,000 people that come into the city. If the first 11,000 people got the car parks, no one else would ever be able to park, and those businesses would die. So it might be a 15-minute car parking space where after 14 minutes you get a text message saying you've got 1 minute left. After the 3-minute grace period, so after 18 minutes, after 17 minutes, the parking inspector gets notified. He gets 1 minute to get there, and you know for a fact that after 18 minutes, he's going to be there writing a ticket. There's no Russian roulette. There's no questions asked. You're just not going to be stupid enough to know that they're going to catch you, because they know exactly what time you parked there. And right now, it's interesting. I got tweeted the other day. Someone was really angry because they got a parking fine. They didn't pay it on time, and the overtime charge was $50. Someone got angry at me because they parked illegally, forgot to pay their fine, and didn't do it, and somehow it's my fault. I shouldn't say that. I hope this doesn't hit the media, but I call parking fines idiot tax. But anyway. So also, another prediction is lower rates, which is really, really exciting as well. You know, a lot of the cost of local government and running of cities is electricity, streetlights, all the electricity we use. If our cities can sense where we are based on the message our phones are giving out, just actually being on and connecting to a network, and there's no one in that environment, the lights can dim. And when people move through that space, the lights can go up. Additionally, if we can have smart sensors that measure the moisture in the soil and tell us exactly when we need to water, and we don't overwater, we start to get a real-time interactivity that actually saves a huge amount of resources, makes our cities much more sustainable, and actually lowers the operating system of a city. And you can do this in so many things. I like to say that many of these ideas are yet to be imagined. I studied future cities by living in Tsukuba, but the truth is that many of the opportunities are yet to be imagined by the next generation. And so there's a really exciting opportunity there. It is ultimately about building this new operating system. The City of Adelaide now has the best Wi-Fi network in the public realm of any city in Australia. In fact, City of Melbourne and Victorian government have come over to Adelaide to actually study our network. It's not 200 unique points around the city. It is completely seamless, totally ubiquitous Wi-Fi in the entire public realm. You talk about demand pricing, you talk about augmented reality. All of the examples I've given you are actually directly relevant to actually being connected 24/7, not through a 3G network, but through a Wi-Fi network. That means that any tourist that comes to Australia can also take a photograph of a beautiful building, upload it and say, isn't Adelaide the most amazing place, at zero cost to anyone. You can then, as an international student, sit in any one of the incredible outdoor dining experiences on our beautiful main streets in Adelaide, and they can sit under a shady tree and tweet and blog and Facebook about how fantastic Adelaide is in real time. When you go to cities around the world, you take photographs. By the time you get home, you're stuffed. You're not going to upload them to Facebook, and the opportunity's gone. You come to Adelaide, you see the beautiful town hall, you go click, 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 and all of a sudden Adelaide is going viral across the world. And so there's a huge number of opportunities there. But once again, I think the opportunities are endless. And it is going to be a change curve, and it's the cities that get in on the ground floor and not only build this infrastructure, but also embrace it and use it, that are going to be the winners. There'll be winners and losers. There's going to be old economies and new economies. And this is the infrastructure of the future. To do 75% of the entire square mile of the City of Adelaide costs Adelaide City Council and State Government $1.5 million. That's about the same as bituminising about 500 metres of road. And it provides the infrastructure of the future that's going to engage young people and also just have people come over and say, wow, Adelaide's got free Wi-Fi. This is a cool city. And it changes the image, changes the operating system of cities, and it's something that most cities will do. We're very lucky in Adelaide. We're flat. We've got a grid system. And as a result, we can actually roll out this Wi-Fi network like no other city in Australia. So good luck trying it, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, but we did it first, and you've got to catch up. A couple of other things that I wanted to touch on, and just try and burst some bubbles around transport, because transport and moving people is going to be increasingly more difficult. Melbourne is doing it now, Sydney is doing it, but Melbourne and Sydney have 1 million people come into their downtown district every single day. Now, I know every single person has spent their entire life looking out of a car window and wants to drive in and park exactly where they damn well want. That is not going to happen, because if you times it by 1 million people, you are all going to be stuck in a traffic jam. It is quite literally that simple. Hands up who rode their bicycle to school when they were kids. Now, keep your hand up if your children ride their bicycle to school. A little bit? No. When we were kids, 30% of us rode our bicycles to school, and now only 3% of children ride their bicycle to school. And the reason is there is a feedback loop pattern that happens with cars that actually induces the very problem that we're talking about. So if we only encourage people to drive into a city, that means the buses would be stuck in a traffic jam. And the people in the bus would say, there is absolutely no point being in that bus. I may as well drive as well. Mm. And you get more cars on the road. Additionally, if you wanted to ride your bicycle into the city and it was full of cars, you'd say, I'm not going to ride my bicycle because it's dangerous. And as a result, you jump on a bus, the bus is stuck in a traffic jam, so you get in your own car and all of a sudden we do the same. CBDs are counterintuitive. So whether it's North Terrace, whether it's Swanston Street, although now that's not a good example, but any street in a downtown district with billions of dollars worth of buildings on the same on both sides of the street, there's only two ways to reduce the increase of congestion in a downtown district. Well, there's three. One is you can demolish the buildings and make the road wider. that cost billions and it isn't going to work. Two, you can, well, that's one option. In fact, North Terrace is a good example. We could reduce congestion in North Terrace by demolishing Parliament House and making the street wider. Now, as the mayor of the city, I quite like that idea, but the truth isn't, is not going to work. The other alternative is that we can encourage people to come into the city using different forms of transport, in which case we will not see an exponential growth in vehicles, which will just induce congestion in the CBD. Now, I would also say to you, just for a moment, imagine what it would be like if the city was induced with just vehicles alone. You know, hands up who wants to live next to a traffic jam. Anyone want to have a romantic dining experience next to a highway? And this sense of the fact that people get angry that they can't drive into a city is actually counterintuitive to the fact that when you come into a city, the first thing you do is park your car and walk around a city. Now, it gets back to this sense that if we're talking about cities being globally competitive, the productive unit in a city is a person. It's not a car. You're not moving cars. You're physically moving people. So if 4% of all vehicles on the road were buses, you would literally double the capacity of a thing called a road to carry things called people. And the aim is to move people. So people don't like bus lanes, they don't like bicycle lanes. But the truth is, if we don't provide that infrastructure and we don't provide transport choices, every single person will drive and we'll all be stuck in a traffic jam. A car uses 26 times more space than a pedestrian, and a car uses 8 times more space than a cyclist. So even if you reduce the lanes of a road and put in the bicycle lanes, if you induce people to ride, you physically free up space on the individual lane to actually make more people be able to drive around a city. And to the point where every single person that rides a bicycle is one less car in your way when you need to drive through a city, and one less car park that you need to compete with to actually do it. The cafe owners love cycle lanes because cyclists can pull up, lean their bike up against the wall, walk in, buy a coffee and keep going. A car drives straight past. In fact, a small business, if they want just car drivers coming to their shops, they are competing with every business 40 kilometres in every direction, because as a car driver you can go wherever you damn well want. If you're a cyclist, you have a certain discrete radii and you will choose to shop in those precincts and you will shop locally. And in fact, it's been proven that cyclists spend more money in shops. They only have a basket, but they go 3 times rather than once. And they build loyalty. And it's been proven that in a traffic-calmed street with bicycle lanes, that's really nice place for people to spend time and not a freeway where the cars go faster, more people spend more money and the business owners know the names of more of their customers. And so 40 kilometres an hour is a great example. If the car is doing 40 kilometres instead of 50 kilometres, they'll see the shop sign, they'll see the shop window, they'll be able to pull into a car park more effectively. When they're walking, the amenity increases and they actually have a better retail experience. I'm often told that we should change the lighting sequence in the city of Adelaide to make the cars move more efficiently and more quickly. But when pedestrians in a CBD environment outnumber cars 5 to 1, and 30 people are standing at an intersection waiting for 5 people to drive through an intersection, have we actually gained productivity or lost productivity? And those people are standing at an intersection in 40 degrees, as is Adelaide's want, or pouring rain, thinking, I hate this city, get me out of here. And so it's this notion that we've actually got to provide integrated transport. There's 87,000 university students in the city of Adelaide, 130,000 people under the age of 30 in our central business district. They can't afford a car, they don't want to fill it up with petrol, and they can't afford to pay for a car park. If they can't get in and out of the city on a bicycle, they're going to say, I hate this city, I'm going to go to another place. And so the idea is that do we want a city full of cars going fast and inducing more because it's not safe to walk, ride or use public transport? Or do we want Australian cities to be cosmopolitan, relaxed, calm, increased amenity, nice places to shop, wide footpaths, people driving past shops don't spend money. People walking past shops spend money. And the more time they can spend walking in a city, the better off they are. Swanston Street's a great example. Retail sales went up 25% within 3 months because the cars disappeared. The busiest street in Adelaide is Rundle Mall. It's the second busiest mall in the nation with 23 million visitors. You can't get a park in that street. It's a mall. And so it's about rethinking cities. It's not for every street, but do you want to have an outdoor dining experience next to a parked car or under a shady tree? And it's those sorts of things that we need to start rethinking how we actually move through cities. As a futurist, I drive an electric car. Now, hands up who's been in a 100% electric car. None of you? Who's been on a roller coaster? Mm-hmm. Remember the instant acceleration?
Yeah.
That's an electric engine. Everyone thinks electric cars are slow and weak, and they only go about 150 kilometres before you have to plug it in overnight. Well, in the city of Adelaide, in metropolitan Adelaide, 96% of all daily vehicle use is under 100 kilometres. So they're only good for 96% of all South Australians. My car uses 2 cents per kilometre in electricity. And if every car was electric, you'd have mobile batteries on the streets. So when the bad guys blew up your power station, you'd have 2 weeks of energy if you used it the right way on the streets of your city. If and when it becomes a smart grid, and they could all plug in. The reason we pay so much for electricity is because of 8 hours a year of peak load. We gold plate for those 8 hours. If every car had a battery and on those 8 hours they plugged in and the electricity went from the car into the grid rather than the other way around, you can actually completely smooth out your energy over a 24-hour cycle and actually not gold plate your grid and have energy security the entire time. The peak is at 8 a.m. when you're all using your toasters and kettles, and the trough is at 2 o'clock in the morning when no one's got anything on. Well, if you charge your cars at night and plug them into the grid, you have flat usage over a 24-hour period. You have energy security, and you can increase the renewable energies into a grid from 25% to 45%. So all of a sudden, that wind and that solar that doesn't necessarily rain, hail, or shine, becomes much more relevant because you can flat out the supply-demand curve in a completely different way. And once you drive an electric car, you never go back. They're fast, they're furious, they're silent. No one can hear me scream when I put my foot down. A Tesla does 0 to 100 in 3.4 seconds, which is faster than a Porsche.
You've got a Tesla.
I don't have a Tesla. I drive a Nissan Leaf. I'm a mayor. I'm not allowed to have a sports car. But my friend Simon Hackett got a speeding fine because he was at the traffic lights. He put his foot down and got done by the camera before he got across the side of the road. They have instant torque at any time. And also imagine sitting in a cafe on a footpath where every car has no fumes, no noise, drops no oil. The only reason high-density urban environments are not attractive is because they're noisy and they're smelly and dirty. Electric engines have 5 moving parts, no oil, and they actually last forever. An electric engine will go for 20 years without actually any maintenance. The real challenge is the batteries, and we've got to get that technology right. And additionally, it's not just electric cars, but it's going to be electric bicycles. It's going to be scooters. What's the speed limit on the linear park leading into the city of Melbourne for an electric scooter that can do 40 kilometres an hour? If you've got bicycles and electric bicycles, a cyclist does 13 kilometres an hour, electric bicycle can do 25 kilometres an hour. Do we need 2 bicycle lanes? All of a sudden, we will see a completely different environment. And when you're sitting in Rundle Street in Adelaide, and every car will be electric, and you can hear the birds sing and the fresh air, you look around and say, oh, I wouldn't mind living here. And all of a sudden, increased densities start to become much more attractive. Now, it's not all good, because if it's only 2 cents per kilometre, and you get that from the solar power anyway, so you're basically getting free petrol, who's going to use public transport? And how does that affect the future of cities? Mm. So I predict an entire new disruptive technology would be the best term, in the very near future, where you pay a premium for a car with a battery, so you've got to use it, so you have to drive it more often to save the money, and you're getting the solar panels, so it's free. And so how does that change how cities work? And it will change very, very rapidly. There is a tipping point, and electric vehicles are on the way, so watch this space. Finally, placemaking is one more I wanted to touch on. We're becoming much more adaptable and flexible in our cities. So just as the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the opening sequence is the Earth being demolished, because nobody actually went to the planning department to look at the plans to see where the new highway was going to go, and they didn't get any feedback, so I'm sorry, the Earth has been blown up. Who's been to a local council lately to look at a plan? No, no one ever does. That's okay. No one ever does. But what we're now doing with placemaking, and Adelaide is leading the way globally, and a lot of talk about this now, is that we're actually consulting by doing. We get guys, and it's mostly guys, so excuse the ladies, from the depot. They whack a whole pile of pallets and table tennis tables and wine barrels and pot plants and fake grass on the back of a ute. They bring it into the city, they whack it in a laneway, and they just actually stand back and say, how do you like them apples? And the small businesses come out and say, what? Well, I like that, but I don't like that. So we move it around. This doesn't work, I can't get into my driveway. Oh, well, let's move the pot plants a little bit that way. And you start pushing the infrastructure around, and you consult by doing. You physically use infrastructure that's lighter, that's quicker, and it's cheaper. And the truth is, young people don't want gold taps. They don't want to go to a fancy bar. They want to sit on a crate with a beer in their hand in a laneway, reinventing the city in some cool hipster kind of way. And they then engaged in the process, whether it be a food truck that you can roll into a place, into a square, that populates a square, whether it be a mobile coffee cart that can actually find a space that was empty and create a space that's being used. There was a small child sexually molested under the Morford Street Bridge in the City of Adelaide a few years ago, and traditionally we'd fence that spot off, or we'd just provide a light. Now we put up a free wall for street artists to come and paint, and we've provided motorcycle parking, and there's always people in that space. And it cost us $2,000 to do. It was lighter, it was quicker, it was cheaper. And we're engaging people in a completely different way. It's changing the culture of the corporation of the City of Adelaide. It's increasing the delegation. It's getting the staff to actually get out of their desks, whether they be the planners, the engineers, the designers, the environmental health staff. They will actually go into a street, talk to the small businesses, and co-create environments to create this opportunity for them to make the place their own and own it. And eventually you use scrappy materials, and it's all a bit of fun. It's like Lego. And then eventually you get it, you nail it, you get it right. And then the designer can come in and actually design the real one. And then you spend the $2 or $3 million that you were going to spend to actually implement it, knowing full well that it's going to work. You know, how many times, Chris, in local government have we actually had to undertake an infrastructure that then we've ended up having to rip up or go backwards?
More often than I care to admit.
Absolutely. Mm. Well, this is the new era of engagement in a way that actually gets people to do things. A bicycle lane can be a series of pot plants down a street. It's not wide enough. Great, we'll move the pot plants that way. It's too wide. Great, we'll move the pot plants that way. I don't want it on that street. Well, what about actually having the north-south on one side? Okay, well, let's put the pot plants over that side of the street. Push them, shove them, get them around, and all of a sudden you start to see a whole different city. I don't like the bicycle lane. It gets in the way of my car. What, don't you like all the pot plants in the street? It's about engaging people. We see bollards to close off a road. Why not just get plants and put them on the street to actually stop them? We put bollards for cafes or really ugly kind of infrastructure. Why don't we get temporary infrastructure? And if it doesn't work, it's easy. You pick them up and you move them somewhere else. You create this adaptive, flexible environment that's lighter, that's quicker today, and cheaper. The best example of a city that's doing it is our sister city, the City of Christchurch. They got thumped by an earthquake that was the equivalent of 40 atomic bombs. Four-wheel drives were thrown 2 metres up in the air. They are now in the process of demolishing 80% of their entire downtown district. And if you put South Bank and the entire HODL grid together, it would be the equivalent of demolishing the entire HODL grid. And they have no money, and they have rubble everywhere, and they are using shipping containers to build an entire new shopping centre instantaneously, and to the point where it's world famous, and they're now going to keep it forever as an icon to what happened. But you can use a shipping container to do bicycle parking for about $5,000. You can actually put a disco ball up with some lights and call it a dance floor in an empty car park. It costs very, very little. And so we've worked with the City of Christchurch to understand how to do that in our city. And we're starting to activate the city and accelerate change. Probably the biggest thing in terms of understanding the future of cities and engaging the community is, no, once again, and Chris, I mentioned him, I know we're being recorded from local government, no one engages in a master plan or a strategic plan or a vision of a city. The idea of doing placemaking and using temporary infrastructure connects today with tomorrow. Everyone is cynical about a vision. Everyone is cynical about a master plan because nothing ever changes. They talk, but I don't ever see any change. The idea of communicating something to people using placemaking infrastructure connects the long-term vision with today. You know, I don't want this laneway closed. I need cars driving down my street. It will kill us. I'm going to oppose the $5 million plan. Well, let's just stick some pot plants at either end. Get a DJ out for a bit of a launch. Get a street artist to put some mules up there. We'll throw a couple of food trucks in, see what happens. If you open this street again, there's going to be war. There's more people walking past my business than ever before, and it costs you $10,000 to try. And you can start to educate the small businesses about the fact that they want people walking past their business, they don't want people driving past their business, in a way that costs absolutely next to nothing. And the staff love it. Morale of Adelaide City Council's gone up 4 years in a row. They're out there doing really cool stuff. Victoria Square in the middle of the city, they're painting dots and they're doing Twister. It costs nothing. And it's all about what can you do to have more fun in your city and create a more attractive destination in a way that actually accelerates change, gives people ownership of the public realm, and educates them on what they actually really need to make the city a nicer place. Now we've got to the point where businesses are screaming to actually get rid of the parking space outside their business and put a parklet because they actually want people sitting outside their business. They want people catching up outside their business. They want a tree outside their business. And it's about doing it in a way that makes them a part of the solution rather than the other way around. Look, I've given you just a handful of examples of the things that the City of Adelaide's doing and some of the contemporary issues that cities are going to face in the 21st century. For me, cities are the future. And the Lord Mayor of Melbourne said to me the day I was sworn in, mayors and their cities are like pets and their owners. If you look around at your mayors and see the city in that mayor and the mayor in that city, you'll start to understand the role that local government plays in actually creating the city. It is real life leadership. It is the community saying, this is the sort of guy that represents the values, the hopes, the aspirations of our city. The real challenge is not necessarily the mayor and the leadership. I think the real challenge is that people are the software of a city. And one thing I have learnt in terms of cities is that everyone wants progress, but change is really, really hard. And the idea that we actually come up with tools and techniques that integrate change into the software, into the people of our city, is fundamentally critical. Because the more time we invest in engaging our community to facilitate positive change, rather than actually getting them to oppose change, the more adaptable, resilient, and flexible and responsive we'll be. And there is only one certainty in the world these days, and that is change. And in the century of cities, there will be winners and losers. And it's the cities that are more adaptable and responsible and flexible to change that will actually be the ones that will be a part of the 21st century economy and actually be those new economies that actually can respond to the changes. So cities are the future, and ultimately, as an urban futurist, I'm always encouraging everyone to think outside the square, but also actively make sure that in the way they actually use a city, they are the change that they want to see in our cities. Thanks.
Stephen, thank you very much indeed. I can see.
Yep, we can do some applause, that's fine.